Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and firm supporter of fiction literature, Mikala Ann. Today, we are celebrating the season one finale of the podcast with a special guest and a beautiful conversation weaving fiction, cunning, and ethics all into one pot and serving it up as a hearty stew to warm the soul. This week, I am welcoming Dr. Alexander Cummins, contemporary cunning man and historian, onto the podcast where we chat a bit about what one can learn about magic and ethics from reading the outstanding work of fiction, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. Al provides great insight and wisdom into the unpacking of this tale by bringing his knowledge and understanding of the dead, geomancy, and grimoire traditions to the table. This conversation does a lovely job on talking about so many things like ravens, angelic language, melancholia, and doorways, but still centers on building an underlining awareness of respect, responsibility, and mutual understanding with ourselves and the world we all share. What can we learn about kingship from the study of ravens? What does the history of treasure hunting teach us about magicians and cunning people of yore? How can a study of the four humors inform a more holistic approach to the care of self and others? All this and more on today's episode of Saturn Vox. To find out more on Saturn Vox, check out their Instagram and Twitter at Saturn Vox, or visit their website saturnvox.com. If you want to support the show towards goals of better equipment, merch, and bonus material, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox.
You know, and it's said that he goes to the gallows less like a man on his way to his funeral and more like a man on his way to a wedding, to his wedding.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
I love how her story also kind of highlights this ambiguity between somebody who's actually channeling and conjuring spirits and somebody who is a fraud. Like, it made me think of Blavatsky. And, like, the everybody is still, like, was she a fraud? Was it a mixture of the two? Was she totally channeling things? Was she being lied to by the spirits?
That's the point, right? Her main spirits that she's working with, along with George, her, like, ghost butler, who apparently sticks with her and is very helpful, tells her when, not the Inquisition, but, like, a bunch of bailiffs are turning up and she skips town. She's kicking around a lot. Parrish is kicking around a lot with this down-on-his-luck aristocrat, Goodwin Wharton, who's racked up gambling debts. And she promises to help him through who she calls the Lowlanders, who are these kind of, like, very Portuguese-looking fairies, basically. They have a whole court, they have priests, that whole kind of like society, and she keeps being told to turn up at points and to look for treasure, but they can't do it today. There's constant delays, constantly things going wrong, it's not quite working out. She also has a series of phantom pregnancies as well. It seems like she's sleeping with Wharton eventually, and she has a series of phantom pregnancies, and Timbers does a really good job of being like, don't know how much she believed of this. And also, Timbers is primarily a historian of gender, using examples of magic to talk about gender rather than gender to talk about magic. Not that you can't do both. And so there's a sensitivity there. But right, like, especially when you're working with, like, fairies and tricky spirits, and especially when you're hunting for treasure, which is not as simple as, like, divining for location. It's also about disenchanting whatever magical traps are around it, appeasing the land in which it is buried that might now feel it's theirs, as well as being right with your spirits who might also want a cut of that thing. So, yeah, as I tell my clients sometimes cheerily, you know, the trouble is more than one thing can be wrong at once.
Yeah, it's like a whole complex ecosystem of spirits within the self and the land interacting with each other.
Yeah, exactly. And also that, like, I think it's Owen Davies who says that, like, we think of treasure hunting now as either, like, pirates or as, like, kind of, there's a sense of, like, that's kind of ridiculous, right? No one has, there's no buried treasure anymore. But, like, there was. And we still find, you know, hoards of Anglo-Saxon treasure. When my mom worked for the Staffordshire, was head of child services for Staffordshire, the car park that she used every day ended up being dug up. Because they found a bunch of Anglo-Saxon treasure there. Like, it does still happen. I think Owen Davies says that, like, hunting for treasure was something like buying a bunch of lottery tickets. Like, the assumption was you probably weren't going to hit anything, but you never know. You can't win unless you play. So you would buy your spades, and you'd find some lay priest or someone that knew some Latin, or, you know, thou art a scholar, speak to it, Horatio. Someone that could, you know, do through some Latin. And you'd see what was what. In fact, there's another instance of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell having a great example of the Westminster Abbey incident, which seems, or the York Minster Abbey incident in that case. That's almost certainly a direct riff on William Lilly talking about using mosaical rods, which seem to be, if not outright full Y-shaped divining rods, seems to be hazel rods a la Scott's Discovery, to look for buried treasure in Westminster Abbey, and a bunch of wind spirits turn up and spook the cattle and everyone else. And he quells them. He knows what he's doing. This is part of Lily's bragging about, like, oh, I used to do magic. I don't anymore. It's the like, oh, I used to be in that world. Or, like, I've left that behind me.
You know, yes, I'm a scientist now.
right. But I also know all about this other stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the treasure hunting is such a deep motif embedded in not only cunning craft, but even ceremonial magic. I mean, there is so many stories of John Dee getting mad at the Enochian angels for not telling him where to find treasure. He kept saying, I want treasure. And they were like, no, we give wisdom. That's not what we do. And he's like frustrated because he's poor.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, patronage, etc. Right. Ever the difficulty of us weirdos. I think it's Benjamin Rowe who says, have one foot firmly in a bunch of angelical material at the moment, that points out, I think it's in Book of Seniors, where he's like, they literally, and I don't think he's searching for treasure, he's you know, trying to understand the system better. He's like, they literally sat me down and took me through why the physical planets in our solar system are in the order they're in. Like, oh, sure, we can get to that thing, but first we got to talk about all the rest of the cosmology. It's like the opposite of, or maybe exactly the same as Carl Sagan's, like, you know, to bake an apple pie, one first must invent the cosmos, right? It's very much that thing.
It's like, how could you find the treasure if you don't understand the mechanisms behind the way this magic is going to work?
Yeah. The part that's fascinated me of late about the various like angelical experiments is how uncharacteristically clear the spirits are about what the celestial speech is and for and where it's from. Like, everything else feels like it has, like, it's very mystic. It's very like, I'm talking about the whole cosmos at once right now, or it's couched in layers and layers of alchemical innuendo and, like, varying degrees of heraldic cant and things like that. But about angelical, the language, they're like, oh, no, very straightforward. It's the language that was spoken in paradise, that was infused into Adam, just like all divine knowledge was. It's the language we all spoke. It's the language he used not only to name all the animals, but also to converse with angels and with God himself. And everything in creation responds to it. Hell will tremble, the oceans will move, like, everything responds to this source code, not just a natural language, but the natural language. and it's uncharacteristically clear. Every other part, whether it's because, for my money at least, the more you look at it, and I'm not saying none of it's workable or anything like that, but there are, again, Roe has a wonderful thing about how there's a real tradition of innovation to Enochian, because it's what's actually transmitted and what we have in the transmission, what, you know, the pages that weren't torn out to bake pies in or to start fires by a variety of servants. It requires some frog DNA, right? Like to rebirth that like Enochian Park, you know. The language is some of the only parts that aren't missing sigils or that might not be appropriate now because it's 400 years later and some of the hierarchies will have changed, etc. So for me, the ritual language is the stuff I keep coming back to and is effective in my work, like. You know, the secret animist key of like, how do you work with like your cards or what? I steal this from my dear friend, Professor Charles Porterfield, you know, tell it to wake up, like wake it up. Do you know how to wake it up? If you don't, work that out. Sometimes also work out how to tell things to go back to sleep or to do something else for a bit. But Zixlay, stir, Zorge, be friendly unto me. Like those kinds of things in ritual language are stuff I use very regularly now. And it I've not encountered a spirit that doesn't respond to it in some way, at least. There is a little problem occasionally of like that what do you call it, language guide 101, when you first learn like, hello, where is the restroom, and you get like a string of someone like talking back to you in a language that you barely speak. So I'm not saying it's always super helpful, but like it's definitely efficacious to some degree.
So there are like formulaic structures of like word phrases that one can say that any spirit class will respond to, as if these metaphorical structures and underlining like formulaic skeletons are somehow universal.
Yeah, it seems that way. It seems that way. And like, I'm always wary of, you know, exactly, you know, spirits lie as well. And I'm always wary of like, are we actually getting at what's going on here? Or is there some kind of kayfabe that's going on and we're playing along in order to get me to do something, to get offerings or to, you know, play this, you know, am I being a cosmic schmuck kind of thing? But so far, at least certainly within like working Goetia and certainly like angelic stuff and some of the bits in between, they're like, oh, yeah, we heard of that, you know. At the very least.
So do you feel like an elemental type spirits who are more like genus loci and of the land, do they respond to the same formulaic language and structure of order?
The way I have been getting at that is through a combination of the angelical ritual language pointed at cohering virtues and spirits via geomantic magic. So via a kind of land magic of sorts, like the thing that is marked in the land, and certainly an approach to whatever may or may not be going on in the Empyrean realms that that bleeds through occasionally when the stars are right. All that stuff, not all maybe, but plenty of stuff is also here in the sublunary world that we can cohere and wake up. Agrippa talks about, like, why do we bother doing ritual at all if the sunflower is already full of solar virtue? And his metaphor is, I would say, not really a metaphor. His instance is, well, you bruise mustard seeds, don't you? Like you toast those cumin seeds a little bit to get their flavor out. You wake them up a little. You remind them how powerful they already are. And for me, one of the key distinctions that I draw between where I may engage in ceremonial magic, but I don't consider myself a ceremonial magician at all anymore. And labels adapt anyway. But one of the key points is where, like, I don't feel I bring my magic into nature and make nature magical in the way I hear a lot of ceremonial magicians talking about. I am here to engage. I just work here. I'm here to engage in a set of like interrelational nodes, nexuses, and flows of occult virtue, influence, and affectivity, and interrelationality. Right? Like again, Uncle Heinrich says, magic is, amongst other things, nature agreeing and disagreeing with itself, right? The friendships and enmities of things. Culpepper says sympathy and antipathy are the two hinges upon which our physic turns, right? Yeah.
No, I love that answer, and it really kind of, to bring it around to the book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, it's very much like, yes, we do want to engage with nature in a way that's more holistic, like how Strange was, but that doesn't negate the educational and like orderly structure of what Norrell was trying to teach Strange. Right. And the consequences that occurred for Strange because he was so anti wanting to adhere to that order, I think is another part of it, because it's like you were saying, like, well, if I over toast that those seeds, now they're burned. And what what can I do with them now? Now there's something completely different, and I've created a completely different alchemical transformation than what I was initially starting out with.
Right, right. Yeah, you wanna talk to the dead? You can always die.
Yes.
Have you want one foot in the spirit world? It can get real harder to have another foot in the embodied human spirit world. To put it like that, you know, there's an influence, and just because those old pacts still exist, have you any more agency, or are you like playing a longer game with a bunch of far older Raven Kings? Again, are you being a cosmic schmuck? Are you being a mark? Like, are you being encouraged to do things beyond your ken? Again, healthy paranoia.
And healthy humility.
Well, hopefully, yeah, right? That you are, again, to engage in those, the old pacts still exist, hopefully is not about I can beat you with a different kind of book learning. And again, I'm fascinated by this concept of books being kept in stones as well. Some of the early accounts of the transmission of geomancy to either Idris in Islamic traditions, or Enoch as equivalent, or even to Adam directly, precede the invention of writing, even in the mythological tellings. Like, oh, it was a stone, but it was a book, but he could read it from the stone. So is it like, I think of Buddhist traditions of like, oh, you find the thing and you activate it, and it's almost like some kind of alien tech that starts spitting out some hologram or something. Encode things and things, but hopefully this engagement with historiola, with like ritual precedent, isn't just a legalistic thing. It's realizing you are engaging in something deeper, and ideally sorcery of whatever sort is not about entering more of not about building yourself a little pocket dimension where everything's what you want, or hashtag good vibes only. it's a way of engaging with the actual world where we can live, and where we have to like help each other and try and be kind, in spite of all the wars that everyone is constantly fighting in their own hearts and lives.
Yeah, oh, that's a fair point, and I think an interesting one for the magician or the witch, because there is an admission, if you take on the path of being a magical practitioner, that you're going to redefine what those concepts of good and bad mean. And then you see a breadth of different responses, even from people within the same camp of magical practice. Right. But that, again, is kind of what I liked so much about the book, because it highlighted in what ways each of them were both right and wrong simultaneously, which, without directly highlighting a middle path, was indicating to the reader that you need a combination of both of these things. It's not about good or bad, but about whole. It's about being whole, holistic health.
Yeah. And anything, anything in excess is eventually, that's fundamental humoral theory, right? That it's about a balance of sorts. And I think there are certain ritual and ceremonial magics that kind of fetishize balance overtly and end up doing that, like, inadvertently crystallized or reified a third way, which has no historical dodginess as a concept to it at all. But for me at least, it's a lot more like being a cat, where like as soon as I've been let in, eventually I'm going to want to be let out.
Yes.
And as soon as I've been let out, I'm going to want to be let back in. To alternate between a practice that forces you to take responsibility and that says, what do you like? What do you want? A practice that says, you know, why are you here, and what are you doing, and what are you serving that's bigger than you? And hopefully, you know, ideally one helps you do the other, that like you're able to stand up and take responsibility and to be like, I will be subject to nothing but the consequences of my actions, you know, and that's the part, that's the side of me that's like, screw the priests, like, screw the, like, you don't get to, you don't own me, you don't get to, you know, my real dad,
yes.
You know, and I will deal with the consequences of what I choose to do. And like, that's the big, like, that's a lot of my, like, teenage anarchism and stuff. And then there's the other side that says, like, sometimes I get confused and I don't know what's best for me. And again, I have to have the car to learn to drive the car, and maybe I'm going to like bang into some things sometimes and learn from my burnt fingers, hopefully, and get better at doing it by that. Like, the first step to being good at something is sucking at it for a while, right? To quote I think that's Jake the Dog, right? But the other side is, you know, I think it is important that we feel that we are, not just that we feel we are, but that we do try and work towards something bigger than ourselves and have a scope beyond our own, like, wild one lifetime round, regardless of whether you think we're coming back or not, and how much we may or may not remember, that we also try and serve something bigger than ourselves, and that can look like things that look like submission sometimes and being told what to do. And ideally, it is, again, for some people that's, you know, are going to lean more towards one than the other in general, but balance is dynamic. It's not a hit exactly this point and just stay on there. It's going to have to provide course corrections as you balance on the ever rolling sphere of the heavens, like in the earth.
I love that. And weirdly enough, what again made me think of Strange and Norrell, but this time about Stephen Black, and Stephen Black being kind of who he was meant to be, the solar self, I think, in a lot of ways. But the Raven King was sort of an archetype that he was representing and playing out. So there was a meta image behind his exaltation of self and his quest for believing that he was worthy of ruling his own kingdom when he was a person who was so oppressed. But there was still a Raven King who stood above him. So there's this idea, again, of exalting the self, but giving reverence to that which comes before us, or which can teach us or guide us even.
Yeah. And that we can, you know, that not only are all, like, is conflict not necessarily abuse, like a lot of closeness can come from friction. If we are happy, you know, if we're able to turn up and be as honest and as open and proud of ourselves and proud of each other, to employ like a solar sense of pride, right? In the grit that can form, or the tensions or the annoyances, there is space to learn more about ourselves and how to be better with each other. I've been thinking about ravens a lot for have a bunch of projects at the moment that aren't quite ready to like announce publicly and things, but I've been doing a lot of work on ravens, and there's a consistent theme across them of the raven being, so there's an image in, we see it in a couple places, but obviously Three Books talks about it. And I think Albertus Magnus in one of the books of Secrets talks about it as well. It's an image of a king. It's a solar image, a king in saffron, a king in yellow. And it has a raven at his breast. And it's this ongoing tension between ravens being of Apollo, because stories, and that's why ravens are black, and also being a futurological bird, a foretelling bird, it's said, being tied to the future, partly through a Latin pun about core being heard as cras, tomorrow, which is why Augustine says that they represent procrastinators and impure men.
I love that.
Right? They are literally denigrated. They are blackened in some very like unpleasant ways, but also in some really fascinating ways. But there's this continual theme of them being at the right hand of the king, but perpetually being not just like the fool that tells that isn't scared of the king or gets to say whatever they want, but is there specifically to... So raven heels are employed against gout, for instance, like the the disease of indulgence and kings, the swollen ego of the solar self, is pricked. The pomposity is pricked by the Black Raven. You see it again and again and again in themes of, like, whether it's Alexander about to siege a city that he's going to destroy his forces trying to take, and a raven like hits him in the head, and it's interpreted as this kind of like impact training from a raven being like, don't do this. It's respectful, actually, for me to tell you, like, no, that, like, you're doing the wrong thing here. I'm not usurping your authority. There's other stuff. Ravens are supposed, like, in the wider kind of natural philosophy, that they're meant to buck hard against command, but if you do best them, then they'll respect it forever. Like a friend that won't respect you until you've had an argument with them. That kind of stuff. So coming back to, like, the Raven King specifically, I'm trying to follow up some stuff around St. Oswald, who has a bunch of stuff around, like, an ash tree and ravens, and looks suspiciously like the Nordic influence in the north, in Northumberland and stuff, kind of halfway between a Christianized masking or syncretization, or there's some things going on there, like trying to trace what the Raven King or Raven Kings might be, or where. And again, not trying to, like, you know, second guess Susanna Clarke or anything, but, like, this clearly resonates, and where are the contexts? What are the other harp strings that are vibrating at a distance, historically speaking, because of this this story?
The one thing that I really immensely enjoyed about what you were saying was thinking about ravens as being associated with Saturn, and how in, like, Giotis mythology, Saturn is actually the child of the sun and mutual understanding. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about what that means for Saturn to be the child of the sun and mutual understanding, and how whenever you stand in the sun, like, you, your physical body will cast a shadow. Mm-hmm. And only in you and another person viewing in the shadow can you meet on equal ground, as opposed to each of you wanting to be the shining sun. It's only within that perspective of our shadows overlapping that we can find a mutual understanding in which we are both sons and neither of us are kings, but therefore both kings.
Yeah. Queens help fix each other's crowns, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Ah, oh, that's awesome. And what a turnaround from, like, so much quote Western stuff around old Saturn, whether, like, the old crone, the baron, you know, like, you know, the hag planet, or you know, Kronos, etc., or grandfather time, or death, or what have you. Oh, that's fascinating. I haven't come across that before. I'm going to chew on that for a while. Thank you. Oh, that's brilliant. It makes me think of, like, the shadow cast also makes me think of, like, you find it in Jewish, Islamic, and eventually Christian lore, that it's the raven that teaches either mourning Adam and Eve, or maybe even Cain, to bury Abel. That burial is taught by the raven. That, like, it is not just not just alchemically a symbol of putrefaction or the grave or what happens there, but, like, teaches it to mankind. Like, shows deliberately, whether it's to Cain to, like, attempt to hide his crime, or to the grieving parents who are, like, going through the worst thing a parent can.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask, is, was it related to a grief song? That was my first thought, was some sort of mourning hymnal being sung by the raven, who is acting as a tutelary spirit.
Yeah. Well, like, they are, that's again one of the reasons they're said to be, I mean, they're said to be smart because they are smart. They're incredibly intelligent, and they can speak human words sometimes. Porter has a bunch of accounts. Pliny has a bunch of accounts. Like, they keep cropping up in the, like, occulted natural history of ravens, that, like, occasionally they can actually speak proper words. There's an account someone gives, it might be Porter, it might be Pliny, of a beloved Roman raven in Rome that would fly up to a particular temple and, like, talk to people all day. And one day it flies into some baker's or shoemaker's shop, and the shoemaker like throws something at it and kills it. And this guy is like run out of town and stoned to death by like this, you know, it's the beloved like emblem of it's the local hero.
That was our friend, dude.
Yeah, that gets a proper burial. And there's also this notion of like they're always tied to burial. There's plenty of stories about like ghosts emerging from the mouth in the form of a raven. What happens when you let that kind of spirit not be buried properly? Like you want restless dead. That's how you get restless dead. You know. And it was already powerful and in between worlds and going between the worlds of the living and the dead. It eats carrion. It has death on its breath. It speaks not just of death but like as death. All these kinds of themes. Yeah.
So, in terms of the book, which was very much kind of about, in a lot of ways, from a Western perspective, it was about like the differences between ceremonial magicians and conjure craft, in my opinion, or cunning craft. But then this axis, but both of them dipping between the axis of the Raven King acting as like a fulcrum. In what ways do you think this idea of death and burial, is it because that is a access point for both kinds of magic practitioners to harness and attach their magic to? Or do you think this was just because of the fact that it was also a historiographic, fictionalized narrative of English cunning craft, and that is just an important aspect of English cunning craft? Or do you have anything to say on that? Or maybe I'm putting you on the spot a little bit.
No, that's great. That's great. I think there's definitely like again, to employ some really, fundamental dichotomies, there's definitely a head and heart thing going on. You know, for all of his academic leanings, it's death that like prompts a bunch of this stuff. It's Norrell that takes money to bring her back, but at what cost? And it's also death and being swindled that like sends Strange off, whether that's like, so which one is the head and which one's the heart at that point is interesting to me. The idea there's a nice geomantic triad that expresses that thing in WandaVision of like Tristicia and Puella creating Amicio and therefore like any combination of those, of two of those creating the other one, that grief is love assisting past mortality. And that, like, that's one of the classic reasons that, like, people seek to the dead, is that we miss them. And it also seems to be one of the many strings on a bow that can be plucked to bring them back. Like, for all of the particular code words that and nomina barbara that Scott delivers of that operation to bring back someone who's promised to come back and serve you after death, like, the personal connection, the affectivity of the passions that like fuel this stuff, is also key there. I think there's also a bunch of notions around, like, for the specific English context, there's a bunch of ancestral stuff. Is the older layer of Christianity, like, what's underneath that? A Christian goose, right? What's behind, what's underneath that? What does the land remember? I think that's maybe the case for I'm not saying like that's that no one else has a version of that, but I think that's riffing on that kind of thing, especially, I mean, the huge ancestral point that I've been thinking a lot about of late, and that's come up in some things, is what does it mean that the rain shall make a door, right? And I think that's an ongoing like question for me, but the idea of like an adventure starts with a portal, right? That's that, you know, is that Tolkien that says that about like about fantasy and things? But also, the English, we're rain people. Ing is a rain god, amongst other things, is probably a title of Freyr or some other like version of Inge. Those lot, like, we are literally made of rain. by the mythic standards. Like,
I didn't know that, but that's fascinating if you think about the disposition of England as a character.
Yeah.
And the way that things have been both nurtured by rain and also monsooned and flooded over by rain, just metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, entirely. Absolutely. A phlegmatic character, a melancholy character. Yeah, for sure. That's an old Bill Bailey joke, right? Like, what's England like? What do you say? Like, we get 51% precipitation lending to our naturally melancholic character. The tea making facilities left a lot to be desired. Hashtag imperialism.
Speaking of this narrative of imperialism and England, there's also a big theme, kind of an unspoken theme within Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell that has to do with class issues. And just for people listening, Al hosted a panel of a bunch of lovely folk practitioners and cunning magicians for the Salem Symposium last year. And I think it's happening again this year.
It is indeed. Yeah, I titled it because if people let me title things, I'll entertain myself, at least. It was called Folk Around and Find Out, of course. It was a wonderful panel that I can take very little credit for. I had to do very little as the chair because we had, my dear friend Jesse Hathaway Diaz, who I do my podcast Radio Free Golgotha with. We had Professor Charles Portfield, I mentioned earlier. We had Doc Bev Smith. We had Aaron Hodges. We had Brandon Weston. I really hope I haven't forgotten someone there. Everyone is coming back to come and do it again for the second one, which is Folk Around and Find Out 2 Back in the Habitat, which is going to be concentrating on not just ecologies of spirit, but like spirits of ecology, and like where does our, not just like particular leaves and what's this plant good for, but like how does being in the land inform what we're doing, and that kind of thing. So again, it's a really easy gig. Like, I can just throw things out to people, and they're all brilliant. So they can just riff for me. I'm really excited for it. That's going to be great. I have another one as well with Jesse again, and with our dear friend Ben, who we're the three moderators of the Folk Necromancy forum that we run on a particular social media platform that will go unnamed for now. I don't know why I got weirdly I've got a secret about that on the Facebooks. That devil we dance with.
Don't speak its name or it will consume your mind.
right? Look not, gaze not into the black mirror. That one's called Dead Excited, again, because people left me to my own devices to name it. And that's on both what it is to, that's going to be on a bunch of explorations of folk necromancy. So I'm excited for that one too.
Yes, definitely not to be missed. I was already going to attend Folk Around and Find Out, but now I have to find the tickets for the other one, but
it's just a great lineup this year as well, as there's so many people I'm looking forward to. I'm very interested in gnome lore and working with various like earth elementals and things, and Linnea McWhirter's doing a whole thing on like Kabuta lore and things like that. I'm super excited for that. There's people talking about Brazilian Kimbanda. There's this stuff on the poison path of minerals, which I'm super excited about as well. I always feel I have to like tell clients, you know, I use malachite in a bunch of stuff for like Amicia work.
Nice. It's one of my favorite stones.
Yeah. It's wonderful. But also like, don't powder that in water. Like, you know, for external use only, etc. Blinding set of lineups. I'm really excited about it. You're speaking as well?
Yes, yeah, I am actually. I'm speaking on the history and function of the Headless Rite. So talking about solar rituals, that's one of my favorite contemplations. So that'll be fun. But just getting back on topic, I don't like to plug myself on the podcast. I want other people to plug themselves. I'm not as important. Very Saturn over here. Gotta stay humble.
Please get us back on track. Have some rules. I need some boundaries sometimes.
Yeah, Saturn coming in to say, okay, weren't we talking about a question?
Mm-hmm.
So you guys in that panel the first time, I don't remember if there was a set theme. I think it was maybe just more general the first time.
There were a couple bits and pieces. There was discussion of what it means to do this, for want of a better word, professionally. What it means, like, I'm very interested in talking about client work and what it means to work fairly, both like by ourselves, like for ourselves and for others. And I also had like a couple of prompts, which I was calling hatches, matches, and dispatches, which is what my dad calls births, marriages, and deaths. Which was also fun because I was like, okay, matches. And people were like, okay, you get a box of matches and you take these ones out and you do it. And I'm like, I meant like, okay, go, fine. Also fine. Interpret the prompt however you will. Attack the question.
Yes, it was beautiful. One of the themes that came up that I felt like was super poignant. And so it was interesting is the way this worked out was Salem Symposium happened. And then the next week I started reading Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. So like that... That panel was very much in my mind, and that one of the themes that had been addressed, I think, especially by Dr. Charles Porterfield and Doc Beverly, was about the class issue and this like issue that we still even see in occult spaces today, even though these are the very people who will claim we're in a new aeon and we're not Christian anymore and dualism is not a thing, but they'll still get hung up on these concepts of high magic versus low magic and my insistence on having read X amount of books on the topic makes me better than your 100 hours of experience is very much a mentality that we see. And I feel like that was the tension between Strange and Norrell as well. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk a bit about that at all, since it's not only relevant to the book, but just relevant to cunning craft at large, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you can call yourself a ceremonial magician once you've got what you consider a good or a braggable amount of books. I don't really think you can call yourself a cunning person until someone else does. Like, you don't really get to be cunning on your own, whether that's from your spirit interactions, from your responsibilities to the spirits you now have to feed, and that you might owe something to, or that like you have to pay fairly. Otherwise, they'll find ways to they'll find things to do. You know, it gets a bit golem-esque in many of those accounts, which you also see in plenty of accounts of other kinds of folk nigromancies. You get it in like a bunch of Chinese stuff. Again, my accents are atrocious, but in Ka, for instance, there's exactly the same thing of like, oh yeah, you can totally work with these spirits that will go out and kill your enemies, but when you run out of enemies, it's going to find more people to kill. And so you have to put it in a bowl and put it by the roadside for someone else to pick it up by their own free will. It's very like, it's very Goosebumps. Etc.
There's that questionable witch morality again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think cunning is where the witch works for others as well, and what that wider thing is. So I think cunning is what you do, as well as what you might know or the books you might have access to. It is a technical term in terms of like, you know, the Anglo-Saxon cunan, like to know. It's in theory just like a person that knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It's a sign of proficiency, but it's also like a sense of, I don't say trust, but like an acknowledgement that he can do things. Like, and there's plenty of like kind of vaguely, there's a lot of like, what's he building in there, you know, by Tom Waits to a lot of these accounts. Like, he does stuff, she does stuff. We're not quite sure how valid it is. It's in the gray areas. It's weirdly at the periphery, but it's also at the center of like social life. and is the crossroads you go to when you don't feel you have any other options.
Yeah.
You know, most of these people, again, we're back to that classic thing. Most of these, if you're looking for like a satanic cult, you're not likely to find it in the sense of people secretly worshiping the devil. But if you're looking for a bunch of people who are desperate to make sure like their kid didn't die, or that like that the crops did well enough to not starve, like absolutely, you're looking at people resorting to desperate means and potentially dangerous things that they knew were dangerous.
Yes.
Think, you know, debts that they knew they were getting into that were not necessarily great. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's one of the most interesting things to me about my own shift in consciousness as I started getting more and more involved in magic, is even because I had a philosophy background, so I was already, you know, informed about things like moral relativism and how difficult it is to put your finger on truth and what truth means. But as I begin to work within magic systems and interacting with other people who have been oppressed and who turn to magic as a way to overcome feelings of oppression and feelings of powerlessness, how these concepts of good and bad, the metaphorical concepts that we have of these concepts in especially our Western society, are very much shaped around richness and poverty. And where the more capital you have, the more good you are, regardless of your actions, at least in the societal view. We could even say that, you know, people who have a lot of capital are behaving amorally, but we don't really do anything to stop them or stop our engagement with what we know they're doing that's immoral, because, you know, it's the structure is just set up to uplift those people. So then it kind of does become this, well, am I really doing something bad, or am I really doing something wrong? To say, engage in sex magic, this idea of the satanic ritual, I'm walking, you know, the Hollywood ideas, I've walked into the woods and there are a bunch of people who are naked, all chanting around these two people having an orgy, which is very much a performance idea that Hollywood likely took from Crowley. And this idea of what was being written about Crowley in newspapers being the most evil man, you know? But was he really evil? What do those terms really mean? I don't think that there is no such thing as a bad action. It's like we were saying earlier, you still want to be humble. You still want to, you know, revert back to the higher entity. I don't want to say the higher good, but the higher aspects of spirit that want us to kind of care about others as well as ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm firmly, again, this notion of like a grassroots cosmology for me as a geomancer is about like, this is where, at least where a lot of stuff is right now in the sublunary realm, and where we arguably have the most kind of action, and action is the best prayer. And we may not all be on the same boat, but we're in the same storm. And as I think I've said on several other podcasts, like my folks are devout socialists, so raised me very much to have this, like, you know, when you have more, you make the table bigger, you don't make your walls higher. And that's very real for me. I think we get a couple dimensions with magic, especially in a disenchanted world, where, you know, to employ that old quip, poor people are crazy, rich people are just eccentric.
Yes, the metaphor is shaping the way we view right and wrong.
Yeah. There's another part I've been pondering on with good and bad spirits and good and bad spirit work, and where capital comes into that, which also feeds back to to treasure magic we were talking about. So in the course of following these ravens, I've become interested in the German Faustian traditions, and kind of exploring those, which initially I was, you talked to me like, I don't know, even like 5 years ago, I would have been like, it's mostly dark fluff. It's mostly 18th, 19th century spooky bollocks. But in starting to go through these texts again and finding some of the antecedents, and they're like, there's all sorts of reasons they are dodgy. Even for grimoires, they lie extensively about how old they are and deliberately mess with it. But there's also a whole vein from these things which are going on from at least the, depending on where we want to start from, if we start from the Compendium of Unnatural Black Magic, like at least the 16th century, Stephen Gordon has a wonderful article on like Hulk Necromancy for the Masses, about that particular grimoire, which is, you know, a real like practical pamphlet culled from all sorts of highfalutin occult sources about how to deal with a variety of things. But one of the parts that really interests me is all this like Germanic folk necromancy around what gets called Stammgeist, which is translated variously as like haunting spirit, also tribal spirit sometimes. The easiest analogy I've found is that the place where you sit at your local pub is a Stammtisch. That's like your seat. That's like your habitual place.
A psychic imprint?
Kind of, yeah, psychic imprint. Stamm itself has all the same things around trunk or root or stem or branch, and so can also signify like clan and stuff like that. And the stuff around like dealing with a haunting spirit is also interesting that I'll give credit where it's due. My friend and colleague Brian Johnson has been doing a bunch of translating of this stuff and pointed out that in these conjurations, which are very grimoric of this, whatever kind of spirit this is, they aren't instructed or requested or compelled to just take on a humane form. They're asked to take on their true human form. We are dealing with something that was at least partly a dead person or is a dead person in some way. And the other part of this that I hope brings in the class element is like throughout an awful lot of Protestant Germany and parts of England as well, a ghost haunting was grounds for a search warrant.
Oh, wow.
Because unfinished business might mean treasure somewhere, might mean, and not, again, not buried treasure like doubloons, but like other, you know, eighth house business, other people's money.
Yeah, and the state wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. State wants it. Other people want it. There's also like stuff around uncanny dead that's more complicated than all the dead are evil or revenants, that there's a sadness to the dead, that like if a ghost turns up, something's gone wrong somewhere. Someone's not been treated right. The social fabric is out of order. And this is like ghosts are what remind us of like what is tried to, what those with the big knives will try and bury, what the man at the top is trying to stand on top of and make you forget that they're on top of.
There's also a level of othering there, in that the ghost is other and therefore scary. Sadness is considered like an othered emotion. It's a dirty, unclean emotion, just like we would say the spirit is unclean.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Layers and layers of melancholia, right. Angus Goland has a fascinating article trying to pick apart all the things that melancholia means, because by its... This is partly Robert Burton's issue in Anatomy of Melancholy, is that, like, if you take that definition of any kind of suffering, as he kind of sometimes... at least implicitly, like kind of goes into, it's all of it. And there's ways of distinguishing tristitia from dolor, of like pain, from sorrow. But like melancholy is a late entry to the, we think the prehistory of the humors starts with phlegm and bile, yellow bile. And then we get like, well, there must be like one that's least bad, like the blood and the sanguine humor in it, and therefore there must be one that's the most bad. Mm. Like they're all poisons, as I've talked about before. Right, when I'm teaching humoral theory, I often reference the high arcane academic source of The Simpsons, and the episode where Mr. Burns is going to the doctors, and they're like, "You have everything. You have all the illnesses," and Smithers is like, "So is he going to die?" And they're like, "No. oddly, there seems to be something we call Three Stooges syndrome. And he's like, let's take these examples of these like little toys. This little one here is your lung cancer. They're all trying to get into the doorways again, of your health, and they're getting stuck in the door. And Mr. Burns is like, so I'm invulnerable. They're like, no, you are absolutely not. Like, you are very, very fragile. Invulnerable, you say. All the humors are trying to kill us in different ways. And very much like, again, certain Buddhist practices, cycle the four immeasurables. Mm-hmm. Like you cycle the humors in a way to make sure that like your phlegm is lubricating, you're not getting too hot and dry from your collar, and your melancholy is grounding, you're not getting too lascivious in your sanguinity or too anxious in your phlegmatism, or you know, too hot-headed in your choleric nature. Or choleric expressions of that thing. But yeah, absolutely. The worst bad poison is absolutely regarded as melancholia, which is also where you get, you know, proto-goth, proto-emo stuff in the Renaissance, of like the deep cogitation that Saturn can bring, which is, you know, is also very, very real.
Me and my Saturn-ruled life, like, all right, well, just hate on the melancholia, why don't you, old humorists? Not right. You, but...
No, absolutely. No, it's there's absolutely a sense here of being of passion being othered, and we are poor as beings is ultimately what it seems most humoralists come back to. And the sanguine humor is the least bad, is sometimes even called like the golden temperament itself, is ideally like the fifth option, which is the balance of all of them. But it's heavily associated with sanguinity, because it said the sanguine person is easily moved to tears, and that passion moves through their heart. And then grief doesn't stick to the heart anymore, as it does with melancholy
yes.
people. So in the very repression of trying not to deal with those things that feel way bigger and that will destroy us, or that will tear us apart, we are locked into it. We clench it more by our pushing it down. And again, the earth at the bottom of all of that things, the gravity of the grave, all of that stuff. We hollow ourselves out. The difference for me as a geomancer that sees professional clients about this, between emissio, grief, loss, emptying, active process, which can be absolutely unpacking your shames and all of what we don't like about our relationship with Venus, to a therapist. It can also be a loss of inhibitions, spewing our guts on a dive bar, whether literally throwing up or you know, drunkenly slurring along with a broken high heel to I Will Survive, right? That's emissio. Tristitia is the hollowed, is how being empty further hollows us out, the open grave we have dug for, in ourselves and our own hearts by trying desperately to push down that stuff.
There are a couple of things that made me think of. The first is, well, when I was studying at an ashram in India, I studied there for a month, and one of my gurus would always say, oh, you have to empty the cup to fill the cup. And now that's actually it's a metaphor that I use all the time when I'm talking about the Ace of Cups, is whether or not the Ace of Cups is reversed or upright, it is a card of healing. Because if we're emptying, we're emptying out something we don't need. Sometimes you need to be empty. You can't receive light or healing if you're full of shit.
Right. But again, I think the active process here is emptying, right? Is not like, not be empty. Not, again, for me, like I struggle like philosophically and personally with the concept of like a lack of attachment, be empty, yes. be not of the world kind of thing. And there's plenty of really valid and helpful and healing stuff about that. Absolutely. But for me, it's about like the active process rather than fetishizing. It's another version of like, I have so little ego that like, I've got the least ego. I'm like the best at meditating, you know?
No, absolutely.
It feels another version. It feels like a very goth version of that.
It's Well, that's why, I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm an expert on Buddhism, but my college thesis was on Buddhism, and then I kind of transitioned into structuring my religious worldview around Kabbalah, and a large part of that was Kabbalah's like, no, we accept suffering. We let suffering move through us like a river, and then it's gone, like it passes through. Just right. Like Bereshit, it means continual becoming. So if we accept Bereshit as the state of God, God's first verb, God is continual becoming. And so me as a reflection of God is in a state of continual becoming. So I'm never empty. I'm always either emptying or filling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's that wholeness.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's fun. The other thing that your thing about humors was making me think of, though, is the metaphor of the poison that heals. If they are all for poison, and like you're saying, this metaphor with Burns and the Simpsons is like, they not all of them could fit through the door. So a balance of all of these different poisons negates the others, which then creates a sensation of a healthy, healed disposition.
Yeah, that balance is the result of saying no to a thing and the opposite of that thing, that any excess is eventually a disgracia, is a bad mix.
Yes. Yes, I love that. And I loved what you said about, like, we sometimes need melancholia to ground us, right? Like, what happens, that goes back to what we were saying at the beginning of the episode, when sometimes you need the sun, there needs to be a shadow in that blinding light so that we can have mutual understanding with the other.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, absolutely. All colors will agree in the dark, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. Well, oh my gosh, this was amazing. This was so fantastic. I think we touched on more than I thought we would. I keep them to an hour, so we're at the hour mark. I do always ask my guest for if you have anything else that you want to say, that you want to leave people with, that you want to share with us. It can absolutely take us on another tangent. Like, you don't have to worry about time, but just whatever you want to say, it's on you.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so the one thing that jumped up, and I'm not going to first thought, best thought, right, is the other thing that's been interesting me of late around melancholia and around the inherent heaviness and gravity of the grave around working with the dead is where that crops up in dream incubation. And in, so finding, I went to the cloisters in New York, which is a beautiful, museum amongst other things. And they were showcasing the Colma treasury, which was a set of, amazing things that seem to have been found stashed by a medieval Jewish family worried that they were about to get pogromed, and that did end up getting pogromed. And one of the things in there is an onyx ring, which is inscribed with, I think the Latin is Audi Vidi, I see, I hear, which, again, talking to translator friends, might be way more complicated than that, but it ultimately ends up meaning that kind of thing. And if we apply that to some popular lapidaries of the time, like onyx is said to be, like, if you want to, it seems to be around not just talking to the dead, but talking to a dead friend. And the thing specifically is around wearing the ring or wearing it around your neck when you go to sleep will allow one. The lapidary says that you will speak and hear your dead friend, and you will know if they need anything. And that's the part that I'm like, oh, okay, so this is an interaction. Yes. This is an exchange. This is not just like the darkest version of dark tourism to the undiscovered country. This is not just like rubbernecking, haunting, like countless. I'm not a fan of like ghost hunting shows.
Me either.
it's an engagement, and for me that goes a little bit of the way to also maybe looking at where onyx is regarded as like a stone you don't keep in the house. In some traditions, like Italian folk traditions, you don't keep onyx in the house. And I think it's if you're not expecting to see a dead friend, like that's affecting. And that dreams put us in places where we don't necessarily know what we're doing. And for me, hopefully, all this talk of crossroads and the self and how we interact is about a kind of vital wit of working out what to do when we don't know what to do, whether that's appealing to our not just our familiar spirits, but our familial spirits, our ancestors, our courts, our shield mates, our elders, if we have them, you know, our patrons. It's also about like reaching in and finding that we're not just the mustard seeds are bigger than they remember, but we're bigger than we think we are.
Yes.
And hopefully, again, that engagement with the world here and now is also about hopefully realizing, you know, we're also part of a continual becoming, and that's itself pretty holy on a good day.
Love that. So beautiful. Thank you so much, Al. This was such a great conversation, and I don't know, now I'm thinking a lot about onyx and ravens and where there might be mm-hmm. a connection between them. It's a very mm-hmm. similar idea, and yeah. they're both
ravens. The main thing they carry back and forth. They carry back and forth between the lands of the living and the places of the dead and the places of the living. They're regarded as thieves in that context, but also as redistributors. They are opportunists, but also they will force you. They will withhold food from their young, it's said, until their blacks come in. So like there's like some big tough love mysteries there. Yeah, some big, again, big Saturn vibes. yeah.
Lovely. I'm kind of bummed. Like we don't have ravens in New Orleans. They don't really live here. We have crows. They're different.
Well, to speak heraldically, it's all corvus. Okay. It's all corvids, like literate corvus, which itself, again, is that Pliny? I'm terrible at this. That's why I write things down. That's why I publish. Externalized memory. It's like a handbag. It might be the word that might have come from, or is said to have been from, hearing ravens and asking, or hearing corvids or ravens or crows, asking them who they are and then responding, corvid. We call them by what they call themselves, because that's polite, right?
Yes.
But heraldically speaking, they're all corbies or corvus. No distinction is made between crows, ravens, for the English, like jackdaws and jays. Jays are a completely different term for a completely different bird. They're all, of that. Rooks as well. And the difference is like, what kind of black do they wear? Is it the black with the purple sheen? Is it the black with the blue screen? Even like magpies sometimes as well, especially when you start to look at, collective nouns, the older term for them is terms of venery, which is wonderful as well.
Is there a Venusian quality to that?
I don't know. Like, because, right, the venal arts, yes. etc. Yeah, I'm not sure where it's coming from. Something about like, something about family, maybe. Roots and, yeah. and so on. Where was I going with that? The terms of venery, the collective nouns, are interchangeable, at least in like in the English context, I'm familiar with. So you can, some of them are specific. A tiding of magpies, you know, all the counting auguries we do, an unkindness of ravens. But there are other brilliant ones as well, and they kind of all get swapped again, because you know when you see the blackbird going across, the most important part of it is that they all wear their gang colors.
Yes, oh, love that. Okay, so on that same vein, I think that besides the beauty of what we're talking about, grief and the onyx and our being right with ourselves, our ancestors, and our ecosystem, you also brought up the etymology of words in old grimoires versus the way that we understand these words now. Like, one of my favorite realizations, which is a game changer as a witch, in my opinion, was realizing that pigeons are doves.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. when you read it and you're like, where the hell am I going to get a dove feather? And then it's like, oh, actually, there's like 50 in my parking lot right now.
Yep. Gutter doves. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I bought a book on pigeons, which is not an occult or academic book at all. It's some journalist just getting really interested
Nothing
in
wrong with that.
Making that same realization of like he was talking to a bunch of pigeon racers in New York, in the Bronx, and then was like, oh, wait, these are doves. Oh, my God. We've been dealing with this for thousands of years, the Venusian animal. One of the things that I learned from my friend Jesse is that doves, I think pigeons and doves, don't have a gall, a literal gall. They don't have the organ that is the seat of Colin.
Wow.
Like and so like this dimension of like why doves, it has this element of like, again, has a humoral theory element. Who would have thought that I would want to talk about that? They are remarkable animals, remarkably fast. They can achieve speeds by how small they are, that are absolutely incredible. If you start to scale that up, kind of thing. If you're interested in, pigeons and doves, there's a beautiful poem by black country poet Liz Berry about a particular breed of their show pigeons. They're the Birmingham Rollers. I grew up in Birmingham. It's where my folks and my sister and stuff and a lot of family still are, in the West Midlands, which both is and isn't part of the black country. It's the city that like is sometimes used to distinguish all the reports of the black country, which is called that because of all the coal. Kind of basically say depends like who you ask. Everyone from the black country has a different idea about whether Wolverhampton counts. Birmingham generally doesn't, but is the city where you go and then come back from. Birmingham Rollers are a particular kind of pigeon, and she has this beautiful, beautiful poem about that these miners are our hands worn hard from being in the guts of the earth were made tender by holding these soft things that they twirl, they spin, they are a spinning dove, wing winged when we look at you. It's a beautiful poem, and she does it in full black country dialect. There's some YouTube clips of it. I'll send you.
And then I can put it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. And like one last comment about doves, and then we can wrap it up. To me, what I thought was so amazing about that is how our metaphorical structure and like the societal norm of the metaphorical image can really distance us from truth. Because pigeons are beautiful. Like if you look at a pigeon, they're iridescent. They're literally like UV almost. They're amazingly beautiful. But we
before Mercury starts to be associated, it's always been associated with quote new colors or mixed colors. But before we have the golden dawn and the ability to make bright orange in those chemical dyes and things, the main color in whether it's in Lily or in a bunch of older grimoires for Mercury is the color of the neck of stock doves.
Oh wow!
That iridescence is an old Mercury color. It's why I use labradorite, which is a relatively new stone, over the last couple hundred or thousand years discovered. It's why I use labradorite, that gray with the flashes and the iridescence to it, for a lot of Mercury work. Yes, they are. They're absolutely beautiful. And that, again, for me, is about... I'm sorry, I'm totally interrupting.
No, you're totally fine.
Is the sense that, like, I think Arthur Waite has a lot to answer for in terms of telling people that grimoires are nothing but people hunting for unicorn horns and impossible ingredients.
Yes.
Like, where am I going to find a dove feather? Like, they're literally the thing that is like also castigated and also like called
that damn sky rat is what I was going to say.
Yeah. Rodents of the sky, right? Exactly. Those which are, denigrated, made black.
Yes.
Literally, right? Yeah, exactly. And again, hopefully this magic, this work of engaging in our crafts of whatever sort that is, our black crafts at that, are hopefully about noticing the world more, paying attention more, and like realizing that there's stuff going on that was already there.
Yes.
That didn't need us to, didn't need us to buy another bookshelf, although I will never stop anyone doing that. I definitely need another bookshelf soon. But that, like, yeah, it's about engagement, and that no tip in an old book is going to be better than like practice.
Yes.
Than do.
Well, you need both. You need the grimoire to say, go get a dove feather. And then you need the cunning knowledge to say, pigeons are doves.
Yeah. The active world knowledge thing. Yeah, again, we're back to this distinction. Okay, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. A practical magician? Would a botanist invent new flowers? That has definitely literally been my experience of doing a history of magic degree in the academy. I've had wonderful teachers, wonderful supervisors, very kindly academics as well. I don't want to like sound bitter or anything, but like I have absolutely encountered that at conferences when I've even given a whiff of being out of any kind of broom closet. So yeah, ideally we don't distinguish between just research and just history. Is that practical? And practice.
That's its
like
own
the one informs the other.
Like how many times people have told me don't go get a master's or a doctorate in magic studies because you actually practice and you will make people mad. That like I understand what academics want is for you to not have a bias. But if their bias is that it's all hogwash, that's a fucking bias. So yeah. I think it's a stupid argument.
No one has this issue with church historians who just happen to be Christian. That's not a problem. That's considered a bonus. Yeah. Like you have
authority.
You have a context for it. You have an authority. You have a grounding.
If you tried to do performance art, get a doctorate in performance art, and you didn't perform art, people would be weirded out by your choice.
Right? Yeah. It's a thing that I could get real bitter about, and I really try hard.
We won't. Instead of doing that, we will just say that the point is, both are good, books and experience.
Yeah, and again, like Angelical, like a lot of these things, like Cunningcraft, they're traditions of innovation. And I don't consider my one foot firmly in the early modern world to be any kind of reconstructionism. I'm interested in the early modern because it's that halfway point between modern and, you know, what Kierkegaard calls like the old dirty medieval magic, like a point where it's a point of transition, a point of change between like feudal lords and cities.
You picked the liminal period to study liminality.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Beautiful.
Because I like to make things hard for myself. Yeah.
Well, in some ways though, you make it easier on you because you don't have to rearrange things from an orderly center back into the liminal. It's already liminal.
Yeah. The crossroads and the library, the archive and the repertoire. Yeah.
I love that. Well, this was amazing. Thank you so much, Al. I appreciated
this. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, yeah. It was my pleasure.